Talk about strong reactions. An opinion column recently published in the Kansas City Star sparked widespread outrage when critics suggested it amounted to a defense of rape. The column was titled, "Women Can Take Action to Prevent Rapes." It argued that women should take responsibility for their bodies by not getting so intoxicated that they become victims of sexual assault or rape. Should the paper have published the column to begin with? And was it right to remove it from its website? We'll examine that issue around this morning with our ethics professors, and we'll also talk about the fairness of the presidential primary process. With us once again are Wayne Vaught. He's the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. He's also a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics, and he's one of my bosses at UMKC. Wayne, good morning.
Always good to be here.
Clancy Martin is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC and a professor of business ethics at the Block School of Management. His latest book is titled Bad Sex. And Clancy, always good to have you too.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
Before we get into our main topic today, I wanted to ask both of you about the events of the past 24 hours and the past week. And those events have produced a whole host of very disturbing visual images, from videos of African-American men being shot to death to images of bodies lying in the streets of Nice, France. Mainstream and digital media have been host to some very disturbing visuals. I mean, this is a departure from the past when news media shied away from showing such violent images. Wayne, what do you think about this shift that's taken place here?
Well, I think it's interesting from a number of perspectives. I think it's an evolutionary process. If you look back actually at news coverage, say, of presidents in years past, the media didn't get into the private lives as much of U.S. presidents.
And then
all of a sudden, that's actually the only thing they seem, often want to cover. You had another shift, certainly, with the Vietnam War, in the Korean War, certainly World War II, World War I, you had news images and news reels that would be played in movie houses. But to bring in the carnage of the Vietnam War into the televisions and into the living rooms of the American population was certainly a major shift in the way the media had covered those types of images in the past. So you had sort of the presidential shift into private lives. You had the coverage of a very public event, a war. And now what you're seeing is a shift into the very private lives of individual citizens. So we're seeing these horrific images posted on our TV screens. And it's an interesting, I think, demographic shift or shift in the ways in which the American populace is viewing the privacy of the individual. And I think that's sort of part of what's going on. And there's been certainly a decrease in that of our own doing. So, can you take these images away? People are capturing them on their phones. They're posting images on Facebook or whatever social media site that they might be posting them on. So there clearly is a shift. There's also been a shift in terms of the games and the types of interactions and entertainment industry in terms of the carnage that you see. So there seems to be sort of a cultural shift that has allowed for this to take place, and then a feeding on that cultural expectation that's allowing the media to have a place where they're now putting these images. And I think there's a lot of difference in terms of whether people are willing or not willing to accept it and the potential harm that that's actually doing to the populace in displaying those
images. I was going to say, there's a balancing act here. This is reality playing out on our streets here.
Absolutely.
Perhaps seeing that reality spurs people to action, maybe as it did during the Vietnam era, Clancy. But at the same time, as Wayne says, is it too much here for people to absorb, particularly our kids?
It's a very relevant question when it comes to children. And obviously, I think parents have as much as they can. It's hard these days because of social media to control the kinds of images that your children are exposed to. Nevertheless, that's an obligation we have with all different kinds of images, and that's not going away. And I think all of us as parents recognize that fairly non-controversial moral responsibility that we have. I do think that your point, when we worry about sensationalization of sex, sensationalization of violence in the media, we should also always remember the incredible importance of free speech in our country, and the rising social impact, which seems to be beneficial, of transparency. And whether or not one chooses to view these images of someone being shot and then bleeding out in a car, or right. someone being mown down in the streets of Nice by a truck. That's a personal adult decision whether or not. However,
but if you can't escape the image, you can't escape it sometimes. Whether you choose to watch it or not, it's, mm-hmm. it's suddenly there on your Twitter feed.
Right. Know? Yeah. Well, I mean, you have some control over that too. But there do seem to be through this. I mean, it's a general rule. I'm kind of an anti-internet person, but I have to admit that. We seem to be having some really interesting public discussions that we needed to be having through the increase of media attention to these, yes, very, very upsetting images. We seem to be sort of shocking people into motion. And as you mentioned, Steve, some of the most fundamental changes that took place in public attitudes during the Vietnam War, for example, were similarly galvanized by arresting terrifying, very upsetting graphic images that we all still remember. Right. So even though I do worry about voyeurism and violence in this country, and voyeurism and violence in the media, I think that on balance, we do better to err on the side of free speech and transparency when we are faced with this question.
On that point, we have a caller here, Debbie from Kansas City, Missouri, who wants to join our conversation at 816-235-2888. Debbie from Kansas City, Missouri, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi there. Thank you. I just wanted to add that even though I agree about the violence being overwhelming and stuff, I think it's important to keep showing it because there's so much happening in Syria and around the world that it happens. One week it's on TV and then it's gone. And unfortunately, in this day and age, people don't read the newspaper or whatever. So I think it's important that we see it, but it be balanced and reported properly. And I was wondering what your guest thought of that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it is a balancing, and you brought up a utilitarian. We've always balanced sort of these issues, utilitarian versus what we call deontological arguments, but the idea of respect for the right of the individual versus doing things that are good for the community at large. And that's kind of, I think, what's at balance here. To the degree that these images and the depiction of the images do public good, that is, if it gets the uprising to recognize, I mean, what we would like to do is to stop the images from being able to be produced because the events are not happening.
Right.
And so if there is sufficient emotional response to whatever it is that's being depicted on the screen, and that causes a good response in terms of the people who are seeing it,
right.
Again, whether Clancy says whether it's sexual violence, whether it's discriminatory acts that we're seeing across the country, whether it's the terrorist sorts of activities that we're seeing, if these generate that people realize, now I see just how horrific this is, something needs to be done to stop the shootings in schools, the shootings of black men, the carnage, then you could say, well, there's a utilitarian argument that merits displaying it. And some of the images, I mean, the things that are just stuck in my mind, you know, the Vietnam era of the guy with the, you know, holding the gun, the firefighter.
Holding the gun to the head.
Holding
of,
the gun know, and that, shooting him.
And you see the bullet hitting the guy.
Absolutely.
It's a Pulitzer Prize winning photograph.
I'll never get that out of my head.
Nor will I.
The firefighter carrying the infant or the child out of 9/11.
I remember that one too.
An image that's just completely ingrained in my head. And so some of the images from last night, though I've read about it, but I've refrained from seeing any of the images. And I'm sure if I did, there will be a new image that I won't forget. And there's a degree to which I think you get so personal. You know, those are up close front. I mean, and the Boston Marathon. I remember the one with the guy carrying the guy holding his vein. Those types of images are so emotionally charged that is there a degree that we cross the line and get into an infringement upon the lives of the individuals and the persons who are deeply affected here versus showing what actually happened, which is, I think, Clancy is trying to say, is we need to know what's going on and know it in a way that we can really appreciate how severe it is. If we said, oh, there was a bus that ran over some people in Nice and that's the end of the story, people might not really be able to fully appreciate and engage in what actually happened or the need for a response.
But is there a danger that we'll desensitize ourselves to these images, Clancy, if they keep popping up over and over and over again in this new world order we're talking about here?
Well, I think we are I think it's relatively non-controversial that we are experiencing a kind of desensitization simply because we have a much higher level of tolerance. I see it in my own children in the movies that they can watch that would have terrified me when I was a child, and they'll watch the movie and they'll laugh, you know? I mean, so I think that it's a legitimate worry that as we get inundated with whether it is sexual imagery or violence imagery or, worst of all, imagery that combines the two in some way, yes, we do get desensitized. And there's a large literature in feminism on this question, when the question of pornography and the depiction of women. So we need to be very aware of our moral responsibility, especially, as we said, as parents, but also vis-a-vis ourselves with respect to the question of the kinds of images we choose to expose ourselves to. And we all know that kind of unpleasant moral taste you get in your mouth of the rubbernecker, of the voyeur, of something that is inappropriate. Mm-hmm. That's a moral voice you should pay attention to in yourself, I think.
Right.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Richard from Shawnee is calling, and he wants to see a little more moderation used in the display of some of these images. Richard, good morning.
Thanks for the conversation. I'm probably adding a little bit to the chorus here, what you've been saying about desensitization. Sensitization, but I want it to be reported. I want to know. I don't need to hear it 20 times. And there are so many media outlets now, and I don't even have a Twitter feed. I mean, I listen to NPR and watch PBS and listen to the radio. But for instance, when the terrorists were executing people maybe several months or a year ago, and the method by which they were doing it, and I hate to use the word, but they were beheading people. Every time at the top of the news the story came up, even on PBS, they used that word. They couldn't say terrorists killed somebody or executed somebody. They had to use that over, and I think it almost inflicts a slight trauma on people that they start to carry around with them and they don't know they have. And it's nothing compared to the trauma, obviously, of people that are involved in these incidents, like the terrible incident in France. But as a society, there's so many outlets out there. They tend to sensationalize. If the only thing they're sensationalizing is celebrity gossip, it's no big deal. But when these events happen and they use those same tools to compete against each other, the result is we get bombarded with things that we don't want to hear over and over again, but we can't escape.
Man, Richard, I appreciate the comments. Man, I can't watch that stuff. I can't. Past a point in my life where I can view it and do it anymore.
That's I can't watch it either. And I do think, however, that's very relevant to the conversation that we're having is that, I will not watch a New York Times video, no matter what the video actually concerns, because I do not want to reaffirm the New York Times belief that they should be converting themselves to a video format, And so, I mean, we do have free choice in these matters, and it's not like we're inundated. Well, or maybe we are.
Okay, let's turn to another big topic in the news this past week. A guest editorial about rape published last weekend in the Kansas City Star. Joining Clancy Martin and Wayne Vaught for that conversation now is Angie Blummel. She's with the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault. That's a group otherwise known as MOXA. Angie, nice to have you. Good morning.
Steve, thanks so much for inviting me.
And I should also point out that I still work for the Star, so our listeners should be aware of that. Let's dive right in here this morning. Angie, what was so objectionable about the column the Star ran that was titled Women Can Take Action to Prevent Rapes?
I think the objection from the community, and I read many of the comments that were posted online.
There were a lot.
Is that the author seemed to be blaming victims for the crime of rape. And we know that the only cause of a sexual assault is the person who chooses to commit the crime.
The victim was somehow responsible. At least that's what the editorial was portraying there.
Right.
How did you react to it?
So as the Rape Crisis Center, we were heartened by the response from the community. Mm. It was swift. It was robust. And it was basically saying, in Kansas City, that's not okay. It's not okay to lay blame at the feet of survivors of sexual violence. And as a community, we're not going to support rape culture and these myths around sexual violence, that someone can do something to prevent sexual violence. Again, the only person that could prevent a sexual violence is the perpetrator who chooses to commit the crime by choosing not to commit the crime.
And so if we go back 5, 10, 15, 20 years, you're seeing a shift in thinking in society, and you think it's a very positive thing.
Absolutely. So years ago in this country, we used to give women in particular strategies to not be raped. For example, don't exercise at night alone. You know, don't take a drink from someone. Don't go out on dates. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, right.
But the conversation is no longer, here's how not to get raped. The conversation is, don't rape. It's not acceptable in our community.
Mm-hmm.
We will not, you know, stand for it, and we won't provide cover for perpetrators.
I want to drill down into a couple of lines that really jumped out at me at the piece that so many folks found so objectionable, and they jumped out at me not in a good way. The author was talking about the need for women to not become so intoxicated that they don't know what they're doing. And then she wrote this, basically, don't yell rape if you regret your actions the night before. But what if you were raped, right? And that's the question there. Then the author wrote this, accept your role in what happened, learn from the experience, and move on. I mean, that stopped me. I think that was a trigger for a lot of people. Angie, am I right there?
Steve, I think you're exactly right. That, I think, was what was so damaging about the piece. Many survivors of sexual violence read it and were probably experiencing that shame and guilt and embarrassment all over again, and were feeling responsible. And they don't need that on their shoulders,
mm-hmm.
because, again, it's not their responsibility.
So, Wayne, in your view, was the outcry over the way the guest columnist stated her position, was that what the outcry was about, or was it the fact that she stated her position at all?
Well, maybe a couple of those things.
Yeah.
I think that certainly the fact there was a lot of concern about the piece being published,
mm-hmm.
And that it being aired at all. And I
should it have been?
Well, you know, I will say that I think the Star aired in two ways. I think they aired in publishing it, and I think they aired in retracting it.
Hmm.
And the reason I would say that is that this is a very serious topic, and the community expects now a much more serious engagement of this topic. And certainly from an ethical perspective, and we've talked about this before, just in terms of free speech, in terms of the need for there to be communication, you want people to be able to express their opinion. And she clearly, as a woman, has these opinions about the nature of rape. It's a good thing that she expressed those, and I think got the response that she did. I mean, in terms of the community saying that, no, this is not the way that we're going to talk about rape anymore. So it did allow for a dialogue to occur that wouldn't have occurred.
There's an educational process happening here.
Oh, absolutely. And
yeah.
So I think you can look at that as a good thing. Now, should the piece have been published? You know, there's nothing I saw in it that was new, that it's not a rehashing of decades old ways of trying to frame the issue of debate. I mean, there are articles, a lot of people have written sort of similar things. So it really wasn't, I think, advancing the conversation in an interesting way. And I think that's probably why there was so much backlash from it.
Mm-hmm.
If the Star had wanted to handle this in a better way, it could have had two guest columnists. It could have had people really trying to articulate, well, if they were going to let her present these views, why are these troublesome? Why
right.
should you not accept? Blaming the victim of rape is the appropriate response to this.
So what was your objection with the paper retracting it? Again, our publisher yeah. was trying to do the right thing and be responsive to the outcry that he was hearing. That was my sense from what Tony Berg wrote in
right.
the paper the next day.
And I think this comes back to a concern about free speech and again, people's right to express their opinions. And so then it came back, well, should those ideas be completely shunned, which, I mean, I think that they should. They should be challenged and questioned. But I think there might have been better ways of the Star having done that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they left the piece up and allowed somebody to respond to it, allowed another editorial to come in and say something, maybe that would have handled it in a sort of a different way. What I think is good was that the Star and that the people who wrote in took a very strong stance against
mm-hmm.
the ideas that were being espoused in that piece.
So there was an advancement here that took place.
I think
in
one way or another there was an advancement that took place. I think it could have all been handled much better.
Yeah.
But
Clancy, your view on all this?
Well, a problem with, I mean, we want to defend free speech. We want to defend the advancement of ideas, and
right.
the media in this country is one of the best places for us to do that. The problem, as Wayne points out, and I'd be interested to speak to the editor, who I have a lot of friends who are editors. I don't understand the rationale of the editor who chose to publish this piece, because it did not seem to have any real educational content. It didn't seem to be advancing the conversation. Now, it so happened, as a contingent matter, an entirely contingent matter, that the public reacted in the way that they did. And so we were all feeling kind of good about it in a strange way, you know, because the community showed that, no, we do not hold this old and now happily idiosyncratic view. But what if the community had reacted differently? What if there'd been a different kind of outpouring from the community, and everybody was saying, yes, well, this is what this is why Stanford, we should be talking about that in a different way than we are as a nation, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
That was just kind of a very fortunate thing, and maybe in part due to the efforts of excellent organizations such as MOXA and a kind of collective increased social awareness of these issues. So there is... We always want to encourage informed, intelligent debate on controversial issues. That's what this show is about.
Mm-hmm.
But informed, intelligent debate is something very different from what starts to verge on hate speech or openly sexist or openly racist views. And we don't publish those in responsible places like the Kansas City
and
Star.
So you questioned the initial publication.
I think it should never have been published, and I think it was entirely appropriate to retract it when they did.
So you support the decision?
I think it was entirely appropriate to retract it. Say, you know what, they made a mistake, and organizations make mistakes all of the time, and it should never have been published in the first place. So we're not going to leave it out there, and we're grateful to the community that they responded in a vigorous way to say, hey, this is not appropriate. This does not belong in the paper.
Angie Blumel from MOXA. I'm wondering, did the author bring up a valuable point, though, about the presence of alcohol in rape? Because the research does support some of the facts that were being laid out there.
So there's this phenomenon of alcohol-facilitated sexual assault. That's a rather new term in the field within the last 5 to 10 years. And we know that perpetrators will seek out persons they perceive as vulnerable. And perhaps a person is vulnerable because they have, you know, they are intoxicated and they have been drinking alcohol. So we know that it's a tool that someone who will commit the crime of rape may use to take advantage of someone.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this term alcohol-facilitated sexual assault, fairly new to the conversation in the last decade.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about Mox's position on the retraction of the editorial. Was there a position taken? Did you have a personal view of that?
Actually, our president and CEO, Julie Donlan, wrote a comment in response and
saying
to the community that the cause of sexual assault is never the victim. You know, it is always the person who chooses to commit the crime. If you have been affected by this article, please contact us. And we provided our 24-hour crisis line number and information so that people could get support, acknowledging this was a difficult article and topic for survivors and for community members to read about.
Mm-hmm.
And then also posted information on our website, our Facebook page.
I'm wondering, we're speaking of alcohol-induced rape, I can shortcut that phrase. I'm wondering about your satisfaction with the level of awareness on college campuses across the country where this issue plays out maybe more often than anywhere else. You're seeing senators like Claire McCaskill in Missouri, other leaders around the country really championing this cause now, whether it's in the military, whether it's on college campuses. I'm wondering to the extent to which you believe the message has really permeated the college culture, not only here in Kansas City, but across the country.
I'm very hopeful, actually, that we are in unprecedented times. The conversation about sexual violence across our college campuses, in the military, in our communities, is rich and robust. There is a White House task force on sexual violence, which there has never been in our history. And I've been in the field for about 15 years, and I'm really encouraged by the conversations that are happening, in particular, the student activism that's occurring across the country on our campuses.
That's interesting.
It's very exciting, you know, to see them stand up and say, this issue. We need to end it, and we can end sexual violence.
Because there's a momentum here right now that I'm not sure I've ever seen before, at least in my adult
years. I completely agree. And again, I'm hopeful for that. There's the movement now, let's end sexual violence within a generation. Mm-hmm. And I think we can do that with, if you have community members like we saw this past weekend coming forward and saying, this is not okay. Yeah. And we're not going to have this in our culture in Kansas City.
Wayne Vaught, you're the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC. This has been a huge emphasis at UMKC going back now a little while.
Oh, it's sexual assault. It's shown all campuses across the country are now focusing on. It's been highlighted and a heightened emphasis on the responsibilities. And there have been some recent articles and publications about universities that have been not been so good. And certainly in sports, there have been a number of football teams across the country where there seems to have been sexual assault sort of endemic to the culture. And I think that we're seeing a lot of heightened awareness, certainly about that. But there is still, and hopefully we can get it done within the generation or with 10 years, but moving it, you know, the thing at the Stanford thing, the trial, and remember the father's response to that was so disturbing, was that, you know, no one could put the blame squarely on where it,
yes.
It was like, oh, the culture, it's the culture that caused me. It was
on.
The alcohol.
Yeah.
That's why it did it. And it's like, no, the reason you raped this woman or assaulted this woman is because you chose to sexually assault this woman. There's one place in which the blame can be placed, and that's with the assaulter. And trying to push the attention in that has been a problem. And that, I think, I will come back and say, is why I agree with Clancy, is that the article should have never been published because it was itself another assault. And I think that's what people were finding, is the article itself was an assault on the women who've been subjected to this type of abuse. Where I disagree with Clancy, we'll come back to that, is in the retraction, is they can't retract the article. I mean, I understand the concept
Once it's
of a
out
retraction.
There, it's out there, you're
but
saying.
But it's out there. It's mm-hmm. there. I mean, I can go find it. Everybody can go find it online. The Star needed to do something with what they had done. It is almost like the sexual assault says, oh, I'm going to retract my sexual assault. You can't retract it. Once it's done, there's an assault. Now you have to figure out how am I going to try to repair the injuries that have been caused from it.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Joe from Lawrence. Joe, you're on the show. Good morning.
Yes. Great discussion. A question for Angie. And I'm asking as the father of a daughter who's been the victim of sexual assault, I see the importance, the extreme importance of moving the conversation toward don't rape, but are you saying we should leave behind the conversation about how to help women avoid risky behaviors and situations?
I think the comment I would make to that is to say that we need to be very cautious in how we talk about people making choices and that kind of thing, because I don't ever want the perception to be that you did something wrong to cause a mm-hmm. sexual assault. Mm-hmm. The consequence of drinking too much shouldn't be, for example, a sexual assault. Maybe it's being a little hungover or something like that, but it should never be a sexual assault. And so being very cautious about how we talk about making choices and behaviors so that people don't ever feel as if, you know, this is your responsibility or you are to blame for what happened to you, I think is the really important piece here.
Let me ask this question, Angie. I mean, so is there any difference in cautioning women about alcohol use as a safety tip and telling people to lock their doors and windows to, you know, reduce a chance of robbery?
You know, it's true. We've been given tips to reduce our risk of becoming a victim of crime but for years, lots of different types of crime. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier, for many years, we were told as women in particular what not to do so that we wouldn't experience rape. But again, I'll go back to that statement about it's not about what we can do necessarily to protect ourselves. It's we need to look at what can we do to support a culture that does not allow sexual violence.
All right. I want to thank Angie Blummel with the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault, a group otherwise known as MOXA. Angie, thanks very much. Really
thank
appreciate
you so much.
It.
Really yeah. appreciate it.
Let's move on to a couple of other topics, if I can get to them here quickly. You know, given that it's a presidential election year, Republicans and Democrats just completed another series of primaries to nominate candidates for the presidency. You know, the process is confusing. It's confusing for me as a guy who covers it. It involves caucuses and primaries. It involves winner-take-all states and proportional states, the use of superdelegates. Now there's ghost delegates out there. So the big question here is it too complicated, and does that make it somehow unfair? Fear to voters trying to navigate all this?
Well, it is very complicated, and I've had a number of conversations actually with my wife about this very thing. Is like the caucuses, and some of them are these small groups of people who just happen to show up or get involved, and others are more of a primary election, and you have differences processes. So, for example, it was very clear, say, in the Clinton-Sanders race that where there were caucuses, Sanders was doing quite well. Where there were primaries, Clinton was doing quite well. So there seems to be the case that certain methods favor certain types of candidates, perhaps, or certain types of electoral strategies that the people would have. And so Sanders was doing quite well manipulating, I'd say manipulating in a bad way, but of taking advantage of certain skills and
yeah.
the rules to make certain things happen. And you're right that you've got this very confusing patchwork system that is, I'm sure, for various historical reasons, is what it is. And I think in terms of and everybody complained about it. Trump certainly complained about how everything was rigged.
Yes.
And everybody's complaining about how the system is rigged. Well, I think it is perhaps an opportunity for us to take a look at what we're doing so that there is equity and sort of fairness. And I don't know, quite honestly, I don't know what is the best methodology. I suppose some primary system where you know, the electorate gets to come out and everybody gets to vote, and it's kind of a preliminary to the actual
yeah.
election, seems to be much more consistent than what's going on here. But I don't know. You may know there's some good things about the caucuses that provide a different opportunity for some people who kind of might not be as able to express their opinion or get their candidates in there if we go to the election process.
You know, Clancy Mart, whenever I see something complicated in politics, I see a system that somebody's taking advantage of out there. That's sort of how it seems to work. What do you make of it? Is it, the states set these rules state by state. This is not a national
right.
thing being foisted upon anybody. There are some parameters that are laid out, but what do you make of it?
Well, I think you're right that I think your basic intuition is exactly on point that the more complicated a particular political process has become, it's normally because vested interests have manipulated in such a way so as to serve their particular agendas. Now, so that's certainly one conversation, a conversation about some kind of intelligent revising and ideally simplification of the various processes we use to elect all of our elected officials. You know, they are incredibly complicated. The other conversation is kind of the discouragement conversation, I guess. And I think one thing that's important to remember in this context is that there's one guaranteed way to make sure that your vote won't count, independent of all the different rules and all the different systems that they use, and that is to not vote. It's also important to remember that even if you're in a state that you know is going to go, or you suppose you know is going to go red, or whatever it happened, and you happen to be a Democratic voter, that no matter how much you may find yourself discouraged by the nuances of the system, at the end of the day, the best way to try to improve the political system is to go and express your opinion about it, which we do in this country by voting.
You wonder about how effective a system is when some critics would say that, hey, it's produced two candidates who are as wildly unpopular as Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are today facing squaring off in the November election. The system can't be working very well if that's what it produces.
Absolutely. There's clearly an indication that there's something seriously wrong when I think it was about 60% of people say they don't trust Clinton and they don't trust Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, the majority of people don't trust either of these people, and this is the candidate pool that we have. And you have to look back and say, wow, how does something like this actually happen?
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, if you look at the candidates that they progressively eliminated, they had strong reasons
for being
even more unattractive than the candidates.
Maybe it's a bad sign of something else as to why we are with the candidates.
You know, like the Brexit vote, a lot of folks might be saying, I want a do-over vote here going forward.
Yeah.
I want to thank our two ethics professors for coming in once again and enduring another round of questioning here. Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin, both from UMKC. Gentlemen, thanks very much. Always appreciate it.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you so much, Steve.